then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you woke up, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's April the 5th, 2012. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Much to my surprise, I didn't get the big agitated response I expected to get from last week's comments on the possibility of admitting repentant former race mixers to the racial struggle. I guess that's either because everyone agrees with me, or else because nobody was paying attention and it's just a radio show for entertainment anyway, so why bother? Nor have the goat dancers gone leaping onto the internet denouncing me as a race mixer. Now, I know it wasn't because nobody was listening, because we're now back up to around 4,300 hits per week on the site, so hopefully winter doldrums are over. What I did get is several comments from listeners agreeing with my decision to include a little more HAC ranting and raving and a little less of the panel discussions. The upshot of these comments being that the show needs to get back to basics and become more focused. Okay, coming up, although I don't think many of you will like where the focus is going to go. One person suggested that every now and then I need to do a quick revision or recap of the whole Northwest Imperative concept for the benefit of new listeners who don't have the time to download and listen to the past 2 years' worth of Radio Free Northwest episodes. All right, fair enough. Spaced repetition is a recognized and important propaganda concept, so let's play it again, Sam. The Northwest Imperative, the concept of a homeland for our people in the Pacific Northwest, is not original with me. And I've never claimed that it was. It seems to have originated many years ago with Pastor Sheldon Emery, and before that, in the year 1941, with the concept of the new state of Jefferson in Northern California, which was an attempt to try and break the white parts of Northern California away from all those Jews and Mexicans in Los Angeles, as well as that whole shower of shit in Sacramento. Before that, you could even say that the first Northwest Imperative was the conspiracy of Aaron Burr and General James Wilkinson to glom onto a good piece of the new Louisiana Purchase and set up their own country. And that was about the year 1810. The idea of establishing small, local white enclaves rather than a whole new white nation is a concept that's also been around for quite a while. Now, on the internet, this idea is best expressed in what's called the Pioneer Little Europe, or PLE, idea, otherwise known as the Beaver Cleaverville Plan, and it's our main competition, if you want to call it that. Now, the basic idea there is that since there are tens of thousands, and indeed hundreds of thousands, of white nationalists, depending on how broad your definition of white nationalism is, what if we could get all of us to move to some little town or medium-sized city like Peoria, Illinois, which is Matt Hale's idea, or some rural county in the Northwest that's very sparsely populated. Now, there's a gentleman whom I have met, and he's trying to do this right now in his small town up in Idaho. Then we get everybody registered to vote, and we take over the local government. We get our own sheriff who hires only white nationalist deputies. We get our own mayor and county commissioners and our own dog catcher, so forth and so on, thereby creating our own white enclave or reservation or Bantustan or whatever you want to call it. And to be fair, this has been done before, although not by us. The Rajneesh cult took over a small town here in Oregon for a couple of years in the 1980s by bringing in thousands of cult members to live in their commune and outvoting the locals. and the Scientologists have done the same in some little town in Florida whose name escapes me at the moment, and I believe they voted in their own city council, which for all I know may still be the case. And granted, all of this sounds very logical and convincing on the internet. Like everything else to do with us, it's when we try to take it off the internet and into the real world that the problems start cropping up. And when you look a little closer, there are a lot of problems with this PLE concept, both practical and ideological problems. Let's go over the practical aspects first. The first practical difficulty that emerges with the PLE idea is that same perennial problem that all of white nationalism has, and that's the problem of character, our character, the perennial disconnect between what is said and what is done. This weird idea that we have that to articulate a problem is to solve it. This complete lack of any connection in our own minds between what we say on the internet and what we do in our real world lives. We're not weirded out cult members, and we simply don't have the kind of brainwashed discipline necessary to pack up and move whenever and wherever some guru tells us to. Would it were so. I, of all people, can tell you this. Here in the Northwest, we have a plan that will actually work, and I can't seem to get through to most of you. With white people, us and the libertarians, the Christian fundamentalists, everybody wants to talk about it on the internet and nobody wants to actually do it. And we're waiting for somebody else to give us permission. We're waiting for somebody else to go first, just like with the Northwest. And it's not just us. This is a white thing. The libertarians are running into this very same problem with their New Hampshire migration, and the Christian fundamentalist Pat Robertson types are running into it with their South Carolina migration. Both of these plans now seem to be pretty much dead in the water. They've gotten maybe a dozen families each actually to make the move, and their assets, resources, and communications are far better than ours. We all have the same situation. The poor character, apathy, and the lack of seriousness of the white population, who are basically consumer herd animals, 21st century units of economic production and consumption. White people don't want to move anywhere. They want to sit on their couches, flick the remote, and go to the mall. They want all their problems solved in place by some magical, fearless leader, so they don't have to exert any effort or take any risk. Now, that's how certain fearless leaders make a living off the movement. They promise white people that these terrible problems can be solved without blood and sweat and tears, and without packing a moving van, and above all, without ever confronting the United States government and its armed men. And white people desperately, desperately want to believe them, which is why I have as much difficulty as I do getting through to people. I don't tell white people what they want to hear. I tell them what they need to hear. And as a result, I get reviled and shouted down and practically stoned online for doing so. We come up with some brilliant idea on the internet, we talk it to death, and then when it comes time for somebody to give up their precious leisure time off work to get behind the wheel of their car and do some long-distance driving to meet people in the flesh, or open their checkbook and write a man-sized check with some serious zeros on it, then all of a sudden we become frightened, we lose interest, and we start wandering away, surfing the net for some other form of entertainment. The classic example was an idea we had about 8 years ago to set up a white nationalist independent movie-making company. Had a whole Yahoo group devoted to it. Never got off the internet. It ground to a halt when the time came to stop yakking online and do some long-distance driving and actually meet. You don't need to remind me that there are honorable exceptions to this, more and more of them. And slowly but surely, we are identifying these people, contacting them, and getting them all ginned up to make the move. But this process is way, way too slow, and I'm really worried that events will overtake us while we're waiting for whites to make up their mind. There are an abundance of internet rumors about mysterious PLEs that are supposedly being set up here and there and everywhere. As nearly as I can determine, and I've done my best to track down some of these stories, none of this seems to be actually happening except in a small way here in the Northwest through us. It seems to be one of our neurotic ways of dealing with the fact that none of us are actually doing doodly squat, that we make up these stories about all kinds of secret activity and revolutionary happenings that the Jew media is suppressing, of course, but none of it's actually happening. The few times that anyone, even vaguely white and racial, has actually done anything, physical and in the real world, we see how the media reacts in real life. They don't suppress it. they descend like a cloud of shrieking vampire bats on whatever hapless group of white boys happens to have screwed up and actually done something. As far as mysterious and secret PLEs go, I simply don't believe that we're capable of keeping a secret like that. There are no secret PLEs out there except for our own tiny primary settlement areas here in the Northwest. The closest thing I've ever heard to someone actually trying it is in two cases. First off, in South Africa, the Afrikaners are trying to create an all-white area in the Orange Free State called Orania, with very little success because they so foolishly handed state power over to the Kaffirs. And here in this country, back in the late 90s, there was a kind of real estate development scheme called Almost Heaven in some rural county in Idaho that was being run by Bo Greitz and a couple of conservative suit types with blow-dried hairdos like televangelists. They were able to buy up some really cheap land and parcel it into home lots. I'm not sure where, but if it was that cheap, it was probably way, way out in the back of the beyond. I think a few people may actually have bought these lots, but whether any of them actually moved out there, I never heard. I don't know. Maybe there is a little community way out there someplace. I do know that there are small groups of Christian identity people in certain small towns in Idaho, mostly leftovers from Pastor Butler's days. Maybe half a dozen families or so apiece. But I don't know if you could call that a PLE. So that's the main problem with enclaves or PLE. Nobody except the Northwest Front is actually doing it in any big way, so we have no idea yet how it would work in practice. But there are also some larger practical problems. Now, in order for the creation of a PLE to be successful, there would have to be a lot of public activity and internet buzz and whatnot in order to attract white people. Now, it couldn't be done secretly. And not just because our people aren't capable of keeping a secret. Eventually, one way or the other, what we were doing would be discovered by some real estate agent or local reporters or something, and that would tip off the government and the ADL and the SPLC and whatnot. Now, one of the naysays that people who don't really want to do anything at all keep coming up with about the Northwest migration is this idea that if we concentrate all our eggs in one basket, so to speak, then it would be easier for the enemy to concentrate their own force against us and destroy us. I could, of course, point out what wonderful success we've been having over the past 15 years by hiding from one another behind our computers, but there is, in fact, a little bit of something to that objection if we pick an area that's so small that the kikes and their gun thugs can surround us. Now, this is one of the main objections to setting up a homeland in an area like, say, New England, which is so small that the existing United States military can surround it and occupy it. Something these Vermont secessionists and New Hampshire libertarians can't seem to wrap their minds around. This is also one of the main arguments against these compounds that a lot of us seem to want to hole up in. Ask the Montana Freeman and the Branch Davidians how well that worked out for them. What are we supposed to do when the FBI and the National Guard surround our compound, run out waving a piece of paper in the air and yelling, "This is my property, I've got the deed!" Ask Ed and Lorraine Brown how well that worked out for them. In the long run, the problem with enclaves in general is that they would be too small to survive on their own, and they would necessarily be surrounded by hostile territory, especially if they were landlocked. They would be very difficult to keep supplied with the necessities of life, which they'd have to import from elsewhere, since the land space and possibly the airspace surrounding the enclave would be controlled by the Americans or by other hostiles, the Aztlan, Mexicans, or whatever situation might arise in years to come. Now look at what the Israelis are doing to Gaza and the West Bank even as we speak, and you'll see the problem with enclaves surrounded by superior military force. Now, do you want your children living like the children of Gaza are forced to exist? I know I've said before that we're talking about a Soviet-style collapse, but we don't yet know for sure precisely how the dissolution of the United States is going to come about. Will it be bit by bit? Will it be one big, huge collapse like the Deacon's One Hoss Shay? How much military force will the United States still command, and to what uses will it put that military force? Will the military mutiny? Will they just sell their weapons for food and wander away like a lot of the Soviet military in Eastern Europe did in the 1990s? Will they transfer their allegiance to smaller states and entities that can actually pay them, like the Soviet military did? We just don't know these things yet. If the Zionist regime in Washington, D.C. remains in even partial power, then some small white enclave attempting to secede would be surrounded by a bitterly hostile enemy and would eventually be overrun and destroyed. Now, this is one of the reasons I think the Protestants of Northern Ireland have never tried to secede, no matter how many times the British government tries to sell them down the river. Ulster is simply too small, and it wouldn't be viable as an independent state. Too small for a republic and too large for a madhouse, as someone once said. A new white nation in North America needs to possess certain geographic, demographic, and economic assets in order to be viable. We need a lot of geography. There would have to be a lot of room to grow into, since we will be taking in the remnants of white populations from the world over. The Northwest is so big that the United States simply can't occupy all of it. They can't put a soldier or a cop behind every Douglas fir. A new nation would need a coastline with deep water harbors so that all access to the country would not rely on overflying or overland travel through hostile territory. There will have to be some kind of navy to resist blockade. Imagine what would happen if the wretched inhabitants of the enclave of Gaza were strong enough and had a navy and an air force to break the Israeli blockade. There would have to be mineral resources, sufficient arable and pasture land to grow our own food, and a sufficient infrastructure in manufacturing, energy, transportation, and so forth, so that the new nation will have a chance to survive and prosper and take in the millions of white people who will eventually flee to the homeland from the ends of the earth, which are still controlled by the Zionists and the liberals. The Northwest has all these things. No other contiguous part of the continent does. Now, I understand that most of these quibbles and naysays that so-called white nationalists put up about the Northwest are simply the excuses of people who have no intention of ever doing anything at all, and so I disregard them. The people who do all this negative nattering on the internet are basically useless to us to begin with, because they're useless to everybody. What you have to understand is that a lot of the opposition to the Northwest migration that appears to exist within the movement isn't really legitimate because it's not sincere. They're not objecting to the Northwest in particular, they're just fighting against any effort to make them do anything at all except sit behind their computers and moan. White nationalists are really top-notch at finding valid and reasonable causes to do nothing. That has to change. Or 100 years from now, there won't be any white people left in North America, anywhere, nationalist or otherwise. This is the Clancy Brothers.
Speed with faces won from Farmstead and from Fisher's Cut along the banks of Ban. They come with vengeance in their eyes. Too late are they. For young Roddy McCorley goes to die on the bridge of Toome today. Up the narrow street he stepped, smiling proud and young. About the hemp on his neck, the golden ringlets clung. There is never a tear in his blue eyes, but glad and bright are they. As young Roddy McCorley goes to die on the bridge of Toome today. When he last stepped up the street, his shining pike in hand, behind him a age of tomb today. Droto the last, Droto the last, he treads the upward way. And young Paddy McCauley goes to die on the bridge of tomb today.
Hi guys, this is Axis Sally, and I'm banged up. I started these gymnastics classes, and they hurt more than anything has ever hurt before. What's funny is some of the other students are in high school, and they tell me it's just so cool that I'm a mom and have tattoos. When it's time for a break, the instructor has us do that thing where we talk about something interesting that happened that day or whatever. But remember when you had to do things like that in order to get to know each other in a group? Now everyone say something interesting about themselves. And there would always be one person who would say something a little too personal or weird. Of course, I never volunteer because I don't want to get kicked out of the class for saying something about how interesting it was that the Holocaust never happened and how one day the Pacific Northwest is going to be all white. So far, the high schoolers have all talked about how someone brought a gun to class or how their school was on lockdown because they got a bomb threat. It's just not even news anymore. They're forced to go to school with dangerous animals, and what do you know? Animals act like animals. I still remember when kids in these getting-to-know-you sessions said things like, I have three cats, or I like to draw. Yesterday, one white girl started her interesting story of the day with, there was this black girl at my school, and immediately the other kids her age said, you can't say things like that, and that's derogatory. Of course, any mention of race is derogatory. No one knew what this girl was about to say, but she was immediately wrong because she noticed another person's race. She made a distinction between a black girl and a white girl. The instructor let her continue, and the girl said that this particular black student got in trouble for making racist comments about other blacks. This immediately prompted a discussion on whether it was possible for blacks to be racist, and whether it was still racism if you were making derogatory statements about your own race. This took up a lot of valuable class time. I managed not to say a word during this exchange, and just listened to what may have been these kids' first exposure to any conversation about race. Some people agreed that it was possible for blacks to be racist, and others of course thought that niggers could do no wrong and everything they ever do or say is justified, and only white people can be racist. And apparently, one Washington school district also thinks that blacks can be racist. Several black Tukwila school district employees have claimed that their black superintendent uses racist language. Tukwila is listed as being a diverse district, with 70% of the kids being minorities. Something about this doesn't make sense. 70% constitutes a large majority. If I have a death camp with 100 kikes and 70% of them get burned up in a pit, you might say that the majority of the Jewish problem had been solved. Anyway, this superintendent also criticized the district for hiring too many blacks because it was turning the district into a ghetto. Well, she's probably right. In other words, one of these middle-class, non-ghetto blacks doesn't like working with a bunch of goddamn niggers. One of the complainers is quoted as saying, "It's so undermining and so immobilizing when someone who you want to embrace and who you want to look up to is throwing your skin color back in your face." Yeah, it must be hard when you're forced to admit that you aren't white, that you don't belong, and that even other niggers can't stand to be around niggers like you. So there you have it. Blacks can be racist. I've been saying for years that I don't want to work or live in a damn ghetto. What is the world coming to when some nigger is taking my side? A few months ago, I got several traffic tickets from one of those automatic cameras that catch people doing bad things. The tickets were piling up. Every week, I'd get a notice of another one in the mail, until finally they stopped coming and I was looking at a total fine of around $500. They allowed me to give a written explanation, so I just said I was a dumbass who didn't know how to drive, and they ended up dismissing all but one of the tickets. So I paid it, and figured that was it, and then several weeks later, they mailed me back my check with a note saying they are returning my payment and closing my file. No explanation. Which was fine with me, but still, what a waste of time and resources. They spent months taking pictures of my car, then sending me the tickets one at a time, then asking for several copies of my written explanation, one for each ticket, and then reading them all, and then asking for my money, and then collecting it, only to send the thing back to me and decide they changed their minds. Someone was paid to do all this, all for nothing. I'm guessing that what happened is they realized I was with the NVA, and they got scared and started wetting their beds. I did have Northwest Front stickers on my car. Anyway, on to something else. We get a lot of emails and letters from people who are convinced that we're all going to die due to some of the worst things in the world, toxins and chemicals. It's mostly Harold these people are concerned about, since he's more important, but I'm starting to get a few worried individuals asking about my state of health due to the contaminants in our air, meat, milk, and water. I think some white people are just determined to be worriers. While they should be worried about the future of our race and of white children, they instead waste time on worrying about the uranium in the Pacific Northwest and seem to think we all glow in the dark here. Or they cry about the impurities in over-the-counter drugs like aspirin. I remember being a part of a natural parenting message board, and you wouldn't believe the trouble and expense some mothers will go to in order to avoid giving their children evil Western medicine drugs like Tylenol. One woman had a very long list of all these homeopathic and herbal remedies. She said she kept all this stuff in a tackle box. We're talking about 30 different substances she was giving to a 2-year-old child to treat one ailment, and she thought that was better than using something she considered poison. A lot of people look at me like I'm about to fall over and die when they see me eating some meat that has been out of refrigeration for a few hours. The amount of raw eggs I consume in a day would come as a shock to them as well. I guess I just have a stomach like a Mexican dog. But what's worse, that or the fact that I actually had my own children vaccinated? I guess I just like the idea of being able to protect them from fatal diseases that are largely preventable. My stock is hardy enough to handle all the preservatives. Please send your hate mail to me personally. Harold doesn't have time to deal with it all. Who is more likely to survive in times of war and famine? Someone with a strong immune system like mine, or someone whose wussy organs will blow up on him if his precious quiche isn't maintained at a precise 36 degrees? Sometimes we forget that we are at war here, and in war we will suffer. Those who are used to hard times will find the suffering easier to bear. When the power goes out, some will be forced to throw away hundreds of dollars worth of meat, while others will still be able to eat it. What are you going to do when gas is $17 a gallon and the grocery trucks can't deliver the food to the stores? There's going to come a time when we won't be able to prepare food to our exact liking. The only thing that will matter is getting the nutrients into our bodies. Some white people really enjoy going to extremes, and I think health faddists are just another example. Now, I don't like seeing doctors any more than you do, because I don't trust them to maintain confidentiality. The last thing I need is that giant swastika tattoo on my forehead being reported to my health insurance company so I can be considered a health risk due to my lifestyle of dangerous extremism. I usually stick a giant SpongeBob Band-Aid over that thing when I go out. But then we get the white people who think that writhing around on the floor chewing on willow bark to treat pain is somehow morally superior to seeing the pain doctor for the pain drugs. Nothing's wrong with seeking alternatives to traditional care. I've tried a few of these different therapies myself and have had a lot of success, and I know others who have had the same experiences. What's wrong is when this obsession with retardo herbs and air purifiers and stupid water filters that get in the way when you're trying to do dishes consumes your whole life. There really are people who say they can't come to the Pacific Northwest because of the uranium in our soil or some other weird chemical that is probably floating around in the air. At least that's a refreshingly different excuse than what we usually hear. We already know the Northwest is full of liberals and that there are volcanoes blowing up all the decent white neighborhoods and bears roaming the streets, and we just kind of accept these things. But I have to admit, you out there who are afraid of all the radiation, I don't have a response to that. I'll look forward to speaking with you all again next week if all the pink slime and impure water doesn't cause me to sprout tentacles that cause me to speed off to the doctor's office. Won't that be a sight for the traffic cameras?
Okay, the past couple of weeks, the big racial news in our wonderful, gorgeous mosaic has been about this nigger Trayvon Martin, 17-year-old monkoid who got shot in the ass in Sanford, Florida, when he was wandering through a gated community by a guy named George Zimmerman, who, despite his name, is apparently some kind of Hispanic, probably a Cuban, The name Zimmerman could mean that he is descended from the Cuban Jews who got out of Cuba when Castro overthrew the Batista regime in 1959. At that time, virtually the entire Jewish population of Cuba packed up and immigrated en masse to Florida. And so it could be that he's not only a Beaner, he's Kike. But whatever he is, he's not white. We've seen his mugshot, and he's basically just your average Beaner, and yet, of course, he's being portrayed as white, and this whole thing is an alleged act of white racism, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, just to go over some of the stories, CNN says, "The national conversation over Trayvon Martin's killing is loud and intense." That's the first mark that you're dealing with a liberal there. They refer to a conversation. I think Hillary Clinton came up with that when she started her election campaign for president. She says, "You and I need to have a conversation about this." Anyway, blah, blah, blah. "The national conversation is loud and intense. In some places, it's also violent, violent." Yeah, from the niggers.
I just don't understand, well, first of all, why this is news. And why this is any different from, I mean, Beaners shoot niggers all the time. Not often enough, I'm sorry to say. But how is this any different than what happens every other day?
Because it's the year 2012, and they've got an election coming up in November. And despite their arrogance, the left-wingers and liberals are very worried about Obama's chances for re-election in view of the complete dog's dinner he's made of the country and the economy. From now on, we're going to see this in the news. Everything from now until November is going to be about Obama's reelection. They're going to twist anything that comes along. If snow falls in July, the question is going to be, what does this have to do with Obama? If aliens land on the White House lawn, it's all going to be about Obama. Yeah, you're right. This is just an ordinary, everyday, minor shooting in Obama's America and being twisted into a big national thing. Anyway, it says, "The case in which a Hispanic neighborhood watch volunteer," or at least they didn't say white Hispanic, like I said, when it first started, they were trying to make him white, "killed the unarmed black teen in Sanford, blah, 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 sparked national controversy, has also stoked extremist views, particularly on the internet, like here." We're extremists, aren't we?
I am.
Okay, yeah. Well, I guess we're part of that extremist view is being stoked here. Investigators are not sure. Oh, here we go. The Southern Poverty Law Center, the civil rights group that fights bigotry and raises millions and millions of dollars that no one quite knows what they do with. Anyway, says the case has stirred up extremists on both sides of the racial divide, blah, blah, blah. Okay.
Okay. Meanwhile, the new Black Panther Party has offered a $10,000 reward for anyone who captures Zimmerman. Now, how large is the Black Panther Party?
I don't know, but they recently upped it to $1 million.
Oh, I was going to say, these niggers can only come up with $10,000 between all of them? I don't get it.
It's probably all they got left over for their welfare checks.
Yeah.
Besides, it's kind of hard to get cash off an ESB card. But, of course, they got to get their pork rinds and their wine and that sort of stuff first.
I notice how they're not out trying to capture him. They're just hoping they can pay someone else to do it.
It's just BS. I mean, I'm old enough to remember the real Black Panthers. We had a couple active chapters in Winston-Salem and Charlotte when I was growing up in North Carolina. And those niggers were always shooting each other. It was basically some kind of nigger gang thing. And one of the worst was a guy named Ben Covington. Obviously descended from some of my family. I'm not joking. No, there's a lot of nigger Covingtons in North Carolina. Obviously descended from my family's former property. You know, after the war, after emancipation and everything like that, and most niggers took the names of their former masters. There's a lot of nigger Covingtons. I worked with one at First Union, old Bubble Lip Sheba. Classy Covington was her name. She was a church-going lady. You know, the kind that goes to church every Sunday, wears a crown, those big hats that they wear, and jump and shout for Jesus. We were getting behind on our work and company, and she wanted us to get down in the supervisor's office and pray. Anyway, okay, blah, 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 blah. Mark Potok, an expert on extremists. Not really. I mean, joking aside, it's not just that I don't like Mark Potok and don't like the Southern Poverty Law Center, but I've read some of his stuff on the website, and the SPLC, really honest to God, doesn't know what they're talking about half the time. I don't know where they're getting their information, but this guy isn't an expert on much of anything except how to get money from the little old nigger ladies. That's what the Southern Poverty Law Center does. They sue people and they say, look what we're doing to the bad old Klan and the wicked old neo-Nazis and Don't you just want to send us all kinds of money so we can keep on harassing and bothering these people you hate? And they frighten the little old nigger ladies with visions of Klansmen under their beds. And they frighten the little old Jewish couples, you know, red diaper babies from New York with visions of Nazis coming after them. And so they all run home and open their cookie jars and send all the money to Morris D's. The incident has created a mob mentality. Oh, God, don't I wish. I don't think anybody's even seen a white mob in this country except very briefly in Marquette Park in 1966. Blah, 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 blah. Okay. Film director Spike Lee tweeted what he thought was Zimmerman's home address. Anyway, it turned out to be the wrong address, and it resulted in an older couple, an older black couple, by the way, fleeing their home and fearing for their lives after threats and crowds outside their residence. Now, when Bill White did something like that, he ended up doing 2.5 years in prison. Lee apologized to the couple and said he would pay for the couple's cost of leaving their home. In other words, they got to move because of this coon, but he's going to pay for it. Oh, that's nice. Okay, another thing. This is from Yahoo. Same old thing. Okay, look, basically what happened is this nigger Trayvon Martin was walking through a gated community, shuffling slow, looking around, wearing a hoodie. It's pretty obvious he was looking for some place to break into or a car to steal or rip off the stereo or something like that. And this beaner saw him, followed him, and called the cops like he should have. They said, well, don't confront him, but for whatever reason he did. The meaner goes up to the nigger, who, by the way, was not some poor little waif. He was like a 6'2", 200-pound football player. And the nigger jumps all over the meaner and starts beating the crap out of him. Beaner gets his gun out and shoots him, and that's it.
Yeah, I noticed all the pictures of that nigger show him to look like he's about 11 or 12 years old.
Probably was when they were taken. Okay, Okay, more Spike Lee. Critics say the Today Show attempted to incite racial anger when it cut crucial seconds from audio of a phone call placed by George Zimmerman just before he killed monkoid teenager Trayvon Martin. NBC News is blah, 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 blah. Okay, what did they do? The networks doctor the news all the time. In the NBC segment, Zimmerman says, this guy looks like he's up to no good. He looks black. That'll do it. I'd say that's a good definition of up
to
no
good. He looks black.
He is therefore up to no good. Well, this guy looks like he's up to no good, or he's on drugs or something. It's raining, and he's just walking around looking about. And the 911 guy says, okay, and this guy, is he white or black or Hispanic? And Zimmerman says he looks black. Okay, so what NBC did is they cut out the middle of that call, which, again, that's the way that the left and liberals manipulate the news. Again, all of this is about Obama's re-election. They're trying to stir up the nigger base and say, we live in a racist country. And also, I think they're trying to frighten all the white voters into running back to the polls and voting for Obama because they're going to be so afraid that they'll be called racist or something.
From Yahoo News, a spokeswoman for an elementary school in North Carolina has apologized for a poorly worded letter sent to parents in February, which suggested the students wear animal print clothing in honor of Black History Month. I think that's pretty fitting, don't you?
Yeah.
Dress them up like monkeys or whatever.
Curious George saying, vote Obama in 2012. In 2008, some woman said that on Rush Limbaugh, quite accurately, that Obama looks a little bit like Curious George. And my God, you thought she'd pissed in a punch bowl.
Okay, this TV station reports that the Western Union Elementary School in North Carolina's Union County sent the letter, which also suggested dressing in African-American attire in celebration of the school's February 28th Black History Day.
In other words, everybody wear their pants down to their ass cracks.
They have a Black History Day, not a whole month, in North Carolina? That's awesome.
I don't think even the public schools can stretch Black History into a whole month. I'm really curious, African-American attire. What the hell do they mean by African-American attire? Right now, it's hip-hop pants down to your butt crack and a backwards baseball cap. I mean, at least in my day, the nigger dress looked a little bit cooler. They had something called dashikis, which are kind of these fancy jackets out of artificial leopard skin. They're really made out of rayon or something like that, but they had little paws hanging over the shoulder like it was a lion skin or some BS like that. And then they had the afros and the berets and the sunglasses. I mean, it looked silly, but my God, at least it looked a little bit better than this garbage they wear today.
The letter was published online by the LGBT rights blog UnicornBooty.com. Now, what does this have to do with lesbians and faggots and unicorns?
Lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender are objecting because niggers are being asked to wear African-American attire and animal costumes or animal t-shirts to school. Yeah, it's...
Okay. While it was well-intended, it was poorly worded, Union County Public Schools Chief Communications Officer Luann Ingram said in a statement, "We are reminding all of our principals to be very sensitive in word choices when communicating with parents concerning different ethnic groups and cultures that make up our world."
God, I hate Southern liberals. I haven't been back home in almost 15 years, but I can almost tell you where this woman came from. Probably went to UCG or UNC and had some kind of education degree and grew up filthy rich and hanging around one of those universities, Duke or UNC or wherever. And I can almost hear her speaking. It's a defilement of the Southern accent. "We are reminding all of our principals to be very sensitive in word choices when communicating with parents concerning different ethnic groups and cultures that make up our world." Booga, booga, booga. I mean, it's just, God, I don't know. I don't like liberals as a whole. Southern liberals make me want to strangle people.
Ingram said the students had been studying the history of Africans who had been forcibly brought to America as slaves, and that the clothing suggestion was meant to honor their cultural heritage, not be a commentary on modern African-American clothing.
Well, okay. I'm curious to know, what did he mean exactly then?
Maybe, what, some kind of rope around their neck and a potato sack? Isn't that what they used to wear on the plantation?
No. On the plantation, they wore homemade clothes out of cotton or wool or later on denim. They wore pretty much the same kind of clothes that the poor whites wore. If you look at them working in the field, they got their pants and their shoes and their shirts and these sort of vests, and they got them straw hats and that sort of stuff. That's pretty much the same people wear when they're working in the tobacco fields these days.
Ingram told the Charlotte Observer that a similar letter had been sent home to students for the past 7 or 8 years and that none of the students' parents had complained about it.
Well, Obama wasn't running for re-election in those years.
The full text of the letter reads, "Parents, during the month of February, Western Union students have been studying Black history. On Tuesday, February 28th, WUES will participate in a Black History Day. We will have speakers from 8 to 10 a.m. We are encouraging students to dress in African-American attire. If you do not have this, students could wear animal print clothing or shirts with animals native to Africa, zebras, giraffes, lions, elephants, etc. Thank you."
I pointedly avoided mentioning chimpanzees and gorillas. But, okay, now what about the white students? Were the white students supposed to wear quote-unquote African-American attire? Were the white students supposed to show up in cargo pants and backwards baseball caps? And
yeah, as if everybody just has this kind of clothing at home?
Trouble is, nowadays they probably do, since so many white kids are Whiggers. They have Black History Day. In honor of Black History Day, all the Whiggers can come dressed as homeboys. Yeah. Sally asked me to play this one. It's Odin's Daughter by Brutal Attack.
If only you could see how beautiful you look on your sweet girl.
Okay, I got an email which I won't read out in detail, but basically this comrade who contacted me is a big fan of the Northwest novels, and having read all five of them thus far, he has noticed certain inconsistencies in the mythos, so to speak. For example, the general consensus seems to be that Red Morehouse's name is Henry, but here and there he's referred to as Martin Morehouse. Dr. Joseph Cord is referred to as James Cord, and there are some other inconsistencies and anomalies noticed by those who are reading my books and actually paying attention, which to my amazement sometimes does happen. Well, my answer is, yeah, you pretty much got me. There are a few oddities and contradictions in the books, just as there are oddities and contradictions in The Lord of the Rings and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes stories. For example, Dr. John Watson is referred to as James Watson sometimes, and on occasion his Afghanistan war wound is in the leg, and on another occasion it'll be in the arm. Even Conan Doyle couldn't always keep track of his characters and plot lines. This is what happens when you write an extended series of stories or novels or whatever over a long period of years. Now, in extenuation, all I can do is remind my readers that these books were written over a period of 10 years when I was occupied simultaneously with a lot of other stuff, and they're still being added onto even as we speak. In fact, I've run a couple of sample chapters from Freedom's Sons Volume 2 on the Thought Crime blog. Now, the fact is that over that length of time, I simply forget what I've written. I can pick up most of my older novels, like The Black Flame or Vindictus or whatever, and I can reread them every few years, and it's almost like they're new to me. Once I get them written out of my system, they seem to be pretty much gone from my mind. At some point in the far-off future, when I actually get a little extra time, and when Freedom Sons has been completed, I intend to sit down and re-edit all five Northwest novels into definitive editions. I'll remove the inconsistencies and all those little things that have turned out to be inaccurate down through the years. I'll tighten up on the spelling and the grammar and get rid of the typos, which still have managed to creep in, no matter how many people I have helping me review the books as they're written. And then I'll republish all five books, including hardback editions for all of them. Right now, you can only get the first three books in hardback. Until then, guys, I guess I'll just have to ask your indulgence on some of these little contradictory points. But I'm not upset when people find them and point them out to me. It shows you're paying attention.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I would like to talk about Forgotten Fatherland, which is a book by Ben McIntyre. This was published back in 1991, after the fall of the Berlin Wall and after the Nietzsche archives became more accessible. This book is all about Elsbeth Forrester and Bernhard Forrester. Elsbeth was the sister of Friedrich Nietzsche, and she was very much responsible for marketing the work of Nietzsche. Also, after Nietzsche's death, she put together a book called The Will to Power, which was made from fragments of Nietzsche's writings. Elsbeth was very friendly with the Wagner family, as her brother was early in his career, although he had a very serious falling out with the Wagners at one point as his career progressed, and really the last straw of this famous falling out was Parsifal, because Parsifal had a lot of Christian overtones, and of course Nietzsche was very opposed to religion. During much of his adult life, Nietzsche was very ill, and he was in and out of lucidity in many cases, so he really needed the care of his sister. She was very excited about his writings, so she was very eager to help market her brother's work. When Elsbeth was not taking care of her brother or marketing his work, she was in Paraguay, and she built a large house there with her husband. She encouraged Germans, mainly from Saxony, as it turned out, to settle in Paraguay to make Nouveau Germania. This was an agricultural colony. Her goal originally was for the colony to be vegetarian, which was something that she and Bernhard and Richard Wagner were very excited about. They were very militant vegetarians, although the foresters were not able to keep up with the vegetarianism once they were in Paraguay. They just found, I guess, that there were not enough alternatives for a fully vegetarian diet in that place. Although the Germans that remained in Nouveau Germania and in Paraguay today, especially in this particular region, do eat more vegetables than the native Paraguayans. In addition to vegetarianism, Wagner was very involved in a type of medical treatment which is called homeopathy, which is a theory that like cures like, that if a substance produces a symptom in a healthy person, that in a sick person that has the symptom, the substance will alleviate those symptoms. And I'm not really sure if there is anything to homeopathic treatments, although I certainly can't blame Wagner for taking an interest in these treatments, because you have to understand that in the late 1800s, the state of medicine was really very primitive. So I really don't blame him at all for having these interests at that point. One of the things that Elsebeth is responsible for is Sir Nietzsche's death, especially. She was very keen to relink the legacy of Nietzsche with the legacy of Wagner, because she felt that the philosophies were complementary and she wanted to see them reconciled. So this book really gives you a glimpse into that era in the late 1800s in Europe, the 1880s, and at a time and place that I think was very idyllic, because really the worst thing that could happen in this little group was that Nietzsche would leave a Brahms score on Wagner's piano and he would throw a fit. I'm sure at the time it wasn't very funny, but looking at it today, I think it's just a lot of the comments made in this book and the comments that Wagner made in writing to Nietzsche's doctor about a possible cause for his mental illness. I mean, in today's world, a lot of these things are very humorous. And so you'll find yourself laughing and crying as you read this book, just going through all the emotions and being very engaged. It's really rather a sad story because Nouveau Germania didn't work out very well. As I said before, there really weren't that many families that decided to be a part of it. And another thing that happened during World War I and World War II is a lot of the men decided to leave the colony because they wanted to fight in the wars, and a lot of them did not come back. So really, as time went on, you had only about 70 families left. There are really very few Germans today in Nouveau Germania because the population was so small and because they ended up marrying their cousins a lot, and the Lutheran minister decided that he would no longer marry people that were related in this group. So a lot of the Germans either had to go into a Mennonite colony to find suitable spouses, or they ended up intermarrying. So that part is rather sad. The author is very sarcastic throughout this book because he does not approve of Bernhard or Elsebeth and their plans for Nouveau Germania. But having said that, it's a very engaging book, and it really gives you a glimpse into Elsebeth's life. Elsebeth is very long-lived. She lives to be 89 years old, so she vastly outlives her brother. She's able to make an archive. She also gets in contact with the National Socialists towards the end of her life and is corresponding with Hitler. And Hitler even visits her once or twice. He comes to her funeral. The book also tells us about the early life of Elsebeth and Friedrich, and Elizabeth and Friedrich, and also their brother Joseph, they lose their father at a very young age, and they end up being raised by their mother and a lot of maiden aunts. And so after Joseph dies, Joseph was a very conservative monarchist, and there's kind of a funny story about Joseph locking himself in his room because he heard about a monarch that had capitulated to some rebels. But Joseph dies young, and after that, Friedrich is the only male in the house. So one of the theories to Elizabeth's strong personality is that she was ignored as a child and she didn't want to be ignored as an adult. But this book really makes very clear that Elizabeth had a very important aspect in Nietzsche's career because she really organizes his work and she markets it in a way that Nietzsche would never have done. And in a way, she's a bit infamous, too, because many people say that she contributed to perhaps a distortion of Nietzsche's work. Although it's very hard to really say, because Nietzsche was really, really very ill first of his life. It's hard to really know what he meant by his writings. I have to say that I find his writings to be very joyful and very life-affirming and very exciting. But I can also see where they'd be very ambiguous, and people have many interpretations of his work because it is so poetic and it is so odd in a way. So I don't think her interpretation of his work is really wrong at all. I just think that his work is very hard to really understand. You know, whenever I hear of sort of a welcome table or a gathering dinner, like I suppose people have when they come to the Northwest, I suppose I think of the end of also Sprach Zarathustra, where they're talking about the roots and fruits and they're sort of having this dinner. I've always dreamed of a dinner party like that, perhaps after a wedding. Because it is so exciting. They talk about the grapevines and the noontide, and I think Nietzsche's work can really be wonderful, but it's a very odd kind of poetry. Another book I'd love to read sometime is a biography of Elizabeth Foster. If I could find it, there is one out there. I think this is a very, I don't want to say the word fascinating again because I use that entirely too much. It's a very intriguing topic to discuss. So that's why I wanted to talk about this book, even though the author does not approve of this early PLE. I still think it makes a very appropriate topic for this show, so I hope you enjoyed my review, and hopefully I'll be back with another review soon.
Moving right along here.
Oh, imagine that.
The Toronto Sun. Apparently, Whitney Houston's gay sister, who's a judge in Texas, refuses to marry straight couples.
I would say half-sister, because this woman's definitely got some white in her.
Okay, Tanya Parker, an African-American lesbian judge in Texas. Well, she might as well be a lesbian. I mean, like I say, you know, nobody likes black women. They're ugly. Anyway, an African-American lesbian judge in Texas refuses to marry straight couples until everyone in the state has the right to marry. Turning away would-be newlyweds is my opportunity to give them a lesson about marriage inequality in this state. Well, I didn't think that was what judges were supposed to do, but not as if anybody's going to do anything about it, of course.
Yeah, we'll just go to a different judge.
You know, she looks enough like a dude. She could probably just walk into a courthouse, like if she were trying to get married just with some other lesbian, and they'd say, okay, sir, here
you go. It's a black Ellen DeGeneres.
Yeah, it is.
Okay. Parker told a meeting of the Stonewall Democrats of Dallas earlier this week. She said it's oxymoronic for her to perform a ceremony that can't be performed for her. Instead, she refers couples to other judges in the courthouse with an explanation along the lines of, I'm sorry, I don't perform marriage ceremonies because we are in a state that does not have marriage equality. Until it does, I'm not going to partially apply the law to one group of people that doesn't apply to another group of people, blah, blah, blah. So, in other words, she is paid money, presumably by the state, to perform the duties of a judge, never mind how competent she is as a lawyer or whatever. But She's paid money by the state to perform certain functions, and she refuses to perform that function because of her own perverted tastes, and she's getting away with it.
Yep. Sanctioned discrimination against heterosexuals.
Oh, Jesus. Elected to the bench in 2010, she's the first gay, blah, 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 blah.
And the first openly gay black, blah, blah, blah.
First openly gay monkoid or whatever. I don't know. These things are happening all over the country. And the fact is, when it does, white people have no recourse at all, except the one that we won't use. So,
and you know, she was an affirmative action through law school and to get into becoming a judge. I mean, she's a threefer. She's a woman, and she's, well, at least part black. Well, she's like a mocha.
Baby shit brown.
She's a cappuccino there, and she's, of course, faggoty. So, hey, there you go. You got three bonuses to get you extra points to get through. So who says she's going to actually have the ability to do the job? She's just given the job.
Well, that's how at all the corporate clients I worked with various temp agencies in North Carolina and here in the Northwest, that's why we ended up with so many black and Asian females on the permanent staff, is they were twofers, affirmative action-wise. They were non-white in some way, and they were female, and I suppose if they were lesbians, yeah, they would have been a threefer. At one stage, before I was born, it looked like my parents might actually turn out to be theater or movie people. I won't go into a long, involved story about them. But when I came along, and I actually came to be baptized, my four godparents were all involved in the theater, or in movies, or television, or whatever, one way or another. Three of the four you would never have heard of. There's one actor whom I could name, and you'd recognize him if you saw him on TV, because he has a fairly well-known face. But he's one of these guys that you see him, they say, who is that? You know, you can never remember his name. One individual, though, turned out to be reasonably famous. Anyway, he took on the duty of raising me in the ways of righteousness and the Lord and so forth when he stood as my godfather. Obviously, he didn't do too good a job of it, so I won't name him and embarrass him, but anyway, here's one of his old musical numbers. See if you can guess who he is.
Used to have old banjos all strung up with twine, and only song you'd hear me sing was, I wish that gal was mine. Well, I wish that gal was mine, boys, I wish that gal was mine. And only song you'd hear me sing was, I wish that gal was mine. Whoa, mule, you're kicking mule, whoa, mule, I say, I ain't got time to kiss you now, my mule's run away. Took my wife to the barnyard and I set her down to supper. Well, she got choked on a turkey leg and stuck her nose in the butter. Stuck her nose in the butter, stuck her nose in the butter. Well, she got choked on a turkey leg and stuck her nose in the butter. Whoa, mule, you kicking mule, whoa, mule, I say, tie a knot in that old mule's tail before he runs away. Face is like a coffee pot, your nose is like a spout, your mouth is like a fireplace with all the ashes out. Well, with all the ashes out, boys, with all the ashes out, your mouth is like a fireplace with all the ashes out. Whoa, mule, you kicking mule, whoa, mule, I say, I ain't got time to kiss you now, my mule's running away. Whoa, mule, you kicking mule, whoa, mule, I say, I ain't got time to kiss you now, my mule's running away. Well, whoa, mule, you kicking mule, whoa, mule, I say, I ain't got time to kiss you now, my mule's running away.
Last week, I spoke for a bit on how we in the white nationalist movement have become world-class experts on how not to do it. We have proven this time and again down through the years as millions of white people flocked away from our organizations in droves. I'd like to tell you a little story which illustrates my point. It's one I've already told on several previous occasions here, but if you've heard it, please bear with me, because it bears repeating. This is definitely what we call a teachable moment for the movement. In December of 2010, a small group of about five guys in North Idaho got the Jim Jams that white nationalists periodically get, to the effect of, gotta do something! Gotta do something! Screw the internet! Screw all this slow business of trying to win people over on a one-on-one basis! Screw trying to build the infrastructure we should have started working on 50 years ago. Gotta do something. Gotta get them television cameras on us. Do something, yeah. And so they did something, the same thing we've been doing for the past 6 decades or so. They dressed up in some kind of Aryan Nations-style costumes, and all 5 of them went out, and they picketed a Mexican taco stand up around Sandpoint someplace. And sure enough, they got their 30 seconds on the local 6 o'clock news. Nothing national, so far as I know. And their 12 or 14 column inches in a purely local newspaper. The cops showed up and took down license numbers and took photographs, probably the Joint Terrorism Task Force and the SPLC as well, so now all 5 of the guys were known. Then, in January of 2011, they found the bionic backpack on that park bench in Spokane, and guess whose driveways were the first ones where the police cars rolled up flashing their LED lights, and guess who were the first ones whose doors got knocked on by our friends in the silk suits. Now, this was not one of our Northwest Front people, so I admit I'm getting my information second and third hand here. But we do have 1 or 2 NF people in that region who keep in loose touch with these men, and I gather it hasn't stopped there. At least some of them are now unemployed, and the visits haven't stopped either. Whatever you do, you do not want to get on the list of usual suspects to be rounded up every time there's an incident. Now, the man who organized this little shindig boasted at the time, "Oh, my boss is cool with it. He likes me. He and I get along great." Well, word got out. And after the 4th or 5th lost customer and canceled contract, his boss was no longer quite so cool with it. Always remember, no matter what they say, no matter how tough or racially he talks, in 99 cases out of 100, you threaten a white man's job or his money or his status in the herd, and he will fold like a lawn chair. The sorry fact is that the overwhelming majority of us are more concerned about their paychecks and their mortgages and what their buddies down at the PTA or the Moose Lodge will say than they are about the future of their race and civilization. Right now, our urgent mission is to make up for a lost half century. We have to find some way to fast forward the tape, all right. We need to create an infrastructure and a network of active contacts and people who have substantial things to offer the independence movement, of a kind that we should have begun creating 50 years ago when the South refused to rise again after Little Rock. It makes me so mad I could spit. It makes me want to bang my head against the wall the way we have dicked off for the past 50 years. But we have. I used to talk about this all the time, as some of you know, but I don't so much anymore because we don't even have sufficient time left for recriminations. Before we can move on to the fun part, before we can really fast forward the tape a bit, somebody has got to do the heavy lifting and the setup. The heavy lifting that our fathers and grandfathers should have done beginning in 1958. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean the slow accumulation of manpower in the form of mature and reliable people who understand that this cause is a lifelong commitment, and they're going to have to clear the decks and get all of this American crap out of their lives, because no man may serve 2 masters, and no white man or woman can serve both the 14 words and the Jewish god Mammon, which is what America is. I mean the accumulation of plant, land, and buildings, and vehicles, and computers, printing equipment, office and storage space. I mean the careful and planned acquisition of certain skill sets by our people that will be needed when the rubber finally hits the road and the time for real struggle arrives. I mean a financial contribution base that will be able to fund a revolution when it comes. I mean the 1,001 little things that have to be done first to prepare for and then to bring about genuine change in the world. Not only is there no shortcut, no way to fast forward the tape, but any attempt to do so almost invariably turns out to be a disaster. Ask those guys who stood in the cold out in front of that Mexican taco stand up in Idaho for 30 minutes, and now some of them are living and sleeping out in the cold, no use to anyone including themselves, because they tried to lock horns with a power structure and found out too late that they had no horns to lock. We have to do this fast, yes, since our window of opportunity is approaching with the speed of a freight train, but we also have to do it right. And we have to do it right from the beginning. No more margin for error. No more endless year after year for experimentation and diddling around with the movement as a hobby or as a form of entertainment and wasting more time on tactics and ideas and strategies and techniques that have proven to be failures. No more practice swings. No more do-overs. This time we have to get it right. And to do that, we have to learn to start using our heads for something besides a hat rack. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98104, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.